Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com. This week on Meet and Three, we're sipping on stories about how access, legislation, and circumstance affect what we drink.
I think now it's really changing that there's a growing excitement about drinks that are zero proof and alcoholic. So it just felt like kind of a very good timing.
This plant's been around for millions of years, and I just think that it's so special, so uniquely American and pre-American, that it just should have a very prominent place in our society, you know, for a lot of different reasons.
It is helpful to be able to sell one drink. It would be more helpful to be able to sell two or three at a time.
Tune in to Meet and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We are talking today with Lucy Martinez Sullivan. She is the founding executive director of Feed the Truth, a new nonprofit that I think we'll be talking about how new it is. Lucy joined Feed the Truth from 1,000 Days, a leading advocacy organization she helped to found, which works to make the nutrition and well-being of mothers and young children in the U.S. and around the world a policy and funding priority. Good luck with that. Previously, Lucy worked with various philanthropic and nonprofit organizations on fundraising and communications initiatives, and in the private sector for Fortune 100 companies. She currently serves as the co-chair of the Global Nutrition Report Stakeholder Group. Welcome to the show, Lucy. Thank you so much. So let's talk first about Feed the Truth, because I had never, before your report hit my inbox, I had never heard of your organization, and I gathered from reading the website that it is quite new. So give us a little thumbnail of that.
Absolutely. Katie, it is a pleasure to be here and to be speaking with you today. So thank you for inviting me. So Feed the Truth, we're a brand new organization. We are in the business of holding big food accountable from farms to forks. This organization was actually started by an ex-food industry executive who saw the real need for an organization to try to drive greater transparency around what the food industry does, their impact on policymaking, on science, because we are dealing with a massive health crisis in this country fueled by our diets and the food we eat, the food we grow. And so Feed the Truth was born from that. And we're really excited to have launched our brand new report called the Draining the Big Food Swamp.
I'm going to tell you, it's not that I didn't know that there was a lot of money flowing from big food, as we call it, into the coffers of the various members of our legislative bodies. But, you know, you guys really drilled down there. I mean, there was some real eye-popping statistics. So let's talk a little bit about how much muscle is, you know, from the food lobby is going in, or from the food industry is moving legislation, and kind of give us an overview of your report, like who were the big players that you identified and so forth.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what this report revealed is really there's a powerful network of trade organizations that are funded by big food corporations that really are calling the shots in D.C., The food industry, it's a $1.1 trillion industry, and it really does flex its muscle through lobbying, through campaign spending, and it uses these trade associations to obscure some of these practices. Mm. We like to say the big food swamp. It's a play on words, of course, in terms of the promise that Donald Trump made to drain the swamp in D.C. to get rid of the lobbyists and the special interests. But there really is this big food swamp. It's wide. There's almost 6,300 IRS classified food trade organizations.
Wow.
But it's also deep. You know, only a handful of those trade associations actually account for the lion's share of lobbying and political donations. And they represent $5 billion in assets.
Yeah, but so damn it, really, do. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. These are big beasts, yeah, right? They're big, big swamp creatures. So
yeah, go on.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, so I think what this report does, Katie, is really just show that the food industry is actually contributing pretty mightily to this larger problem of big money in politics. Mm-hmm. And it has real world impact, right? From the food that ends up on our kids' lunch trays to how our food workers get paid, to whether people working in the restaurant industry can access healthcare. All of these things have, you know, have such an impact on our daily lives, and really, it's quite the story to tell around the influence of big food money in politics.
Well, we're going
to
get pretty granular with this. So, you just said that we're talking about six thousand organizations, which together control roughly $5 billion with a B dollars in spending when it comes to lobbying and campaign contributions. So. Who exactly, how are they disseminating this money, I guess, is what I want to know first. Like, these lobbying groups, are they contributing directly to candidates' election campaigns? Where is that $5 billion going, basically?
Yeah, so our analysis revealed the top groups spent over $300 million in federal lobbying just in the last decade, right? So we took a look at the top 100 group and from 100 trade groups, and from there we narrowed it down to the biggest spenders in terms of lobbying and campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. Then those same 20 groups spent $33 million to influence our elections over the last decade.
Okay.
But really, that's just the tip of the big food money iceberg, as we like to say, because there's all this dark money that's also flowing in the system.
Yeah,
I think what's important to realize is, you know, for perspective, you know, the entire agribusiness industry spent $170 million on campaign contributions in the 2020 election cycle alone. So not just the trade associations, but also the companies and other groups affiliated with the ag industry and the food industry. And that's nearly four times more than the defense industry spent, and on par with what the big oil companies and the oil industry spent. So I think, you know, there's this perception that, you know, it's big tech, big pharma, big oil that are really, you know, the lobbying and campaign contributions powerhouses, but big food is a massive player in this space.
Absolutely. Lucy, when you talk about lobbying, I just want to be sure I even understand that term correctly. When people are lobbying, it's like they're sending some kind of a representative from K Street, which I, you know, I, like everybody else, I know K Street is the sort of lobbying central for most organizations. And they go directly into congressional and senatorial members' offices, and they have sit downs with them to tell them why they should or should not vote in one way or another on specific pieces of legislation. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And it's about these big food corporations using these trade associations to advance their interests, mm-hmm. to make sure that that their interests are protected, that their profits are protected, that there isn't, you know, legislation that's going to get in the way of them reaping big windfall profits, mm-hmm. Legislation like raising the minimum wage or expanding the Affordable Care mm-hmm. Act or things of that nature. So these companies, through these trade associations, exert a lot of influence over policymakers. It's not just the lobbying, it's the campaign contributions that also really open the doors to these big food corporations setting policy. And what's more is the vast majority of the lobbyists in these trade associations that we profiled, over 80% of them are what we call revolvers.
Yes.
They're people that revolve between government and the private sector. And so that, of course, has a huge impact on, you know, who's writing the rules of the system, who's who's making the policy decisions and at the table when big you know, when big pieces of legislation are being discussed.
Right. So our most obvious and recent example, of course, is Tom Vilsack securing another tenure as Secretary of Agriculture after concluding a successful 4-year multi-million-dollar contract with the Dairy Export Federation, or whatever his organization was called. I can't remember what, but it was a lobbying organization. And that he is just the most recent, but there are lots and lots of those. I mean, even I know in USDA, there are many revolving doors. I know that, say, Food Safety and Inspection Services has a lot of lobby, a lot of revolving door kinds of guys. And the way that they can operate is obviously they create these relationships with their buddies when they're on the inside of government, and then they continue those relationships when they emerge to join a lobbying group. So it is indeed a very pernicious cycle. So let's talk about the three big groups in particular that you profiled, because that was that was very sobering, I must say. Who are they, and why did you pick them over some of the other also very large groups? Because there's, as you said, I think, didn't you say there were about 20 really powerful lobbying groups? And then, of course, thousands of other smaller ones. But
yeah,
you picked three very big ones, and let's talk about them.
Yes. So the 300 million that the top 20 food industry groups spent on lobbying, only three groups accounted for half of that spending, right? And so these three groups are the National Restaurant Association, the Consumer Brands Association, and the American Beverage Association. So these three groups are sort of the lobbying powerhouses in Washington, D.C. And they also spent big on campaign contributions. So it's why we picked those. And 80% of the lobbyists of those three groups are people that had been in government before, these so-called revolvers. Mm-hmm. And these groups lobby on a range of issues that impact everyday Americans, right? From, as I mentioned, the minimum wage to worker protections to labeling on foods to taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. So the lobbying might that these three groups in particular employ have huge ramifications for our lives, for the way our food is grown, for the way our food is marketed, sold, and by whom. So it was important to take a deeper look at these three groups.
Yeah. And just as an aside, I'm going to ask, are you going to continue with these investigations and maybe publish another report in another 6 months or a year that defines some of the other organizations that are so pernicious and so influential?
Absolutely. And we're not going to wait that long, Katie, because this is real time impacts that this is having, right? I think there's a lot of conversations around how, how compromised our democracy is to special interests, to big money. Yeah. And certainly food is no exception. I think this really came into the forefront on January 6th with the insurrection in the Capitol and the lawmakers in Congress that voted against certifying the election of Joe Biden. We actually took a look at the top 20 big food industry associations to those 147 members of Congress who voted against certifying Biden's election. Oh, really? And they gave the election, they gave the election deniers $6.2 million. And these industry associations spent more money per election denier than they did on those who didn't vote or who did vote, to affirm sort of our free and fair election and the will of the people. So this is not an issue that's going away, mm-hmm. right? And this is an issue that deserves greater scrutiny. The political power of the food industry and how that power is harming our democracy. It's harming our health. It's harming our environment.
Yeah.
So this is really where Feed the Truth is going to be, kind of at this intersection of food, democracy, and equity.
Very interesting. Now, I'm going to read a little quote from the report, which said the food industry seeks to conceal the depth of its influence by funding multiple trade associations that market misleading information under the guise of consumer empowerment while using its vast resources to shape policy. So Let's go back to that sort of trade association market the misleading information that they are able to. Give us a couple examples of what that might look like to start with. And then let's talk a little bit about dark money, because that's always a very a very dark topic.
Absolutely. So these trade associations, I think they do a good job in spending a lot of money on PR and communications to try to position themselves as champions of the little guys, right? You think that the National Restaurant Association, for example, is fighting for the mom and pop, you know, pizza shops around the corner, when in reality, it's these big corporations like Pepsi and Coke and Darden that are really flexing their muscle within the National Restaurant Association. And the National Restaurant Association has been pretty much fighting tooth and nail against the Raise the Wage Act, yeah, which serves to increase the federal minimum wage, which, you know, of course, is such a critical tool to help fight the crisis of hunger and poverty and inequality that we have in this country. So you've really got this group, the National Restaurant Association, that's fighting against something that would benefit millions of people and would have a dramatic impact on the ability for families, and particularly families from communities of color, to, you know, to have a better, a fairer shot and greater opportunity at the American dream.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing. The Consumer Brands Association, you know, we talk about transparency. This group was really at the forefront of fighting against transparency labeling efforts on GMO, right, on genetically modified food. And, you know, they tried to lobby for their own sort of version that was more focused on self-regulation. And they continue to do this, right? They're doing this right now with a labeling system that presents key nutrition information on the front of packed foods, but they really don't want to be regulated in this way. They'd rather do a sort of a voluntary approach to this. And so it's these big corporations hiding behind these trade associations. So the big corporations like the Pepsis get to talk about their commitment to Black Lives Matter and empowering communities and what an ethical company they are. But meanwhile, on the other hand, you've got, you know, Pepsi as a member of the National Restaurant Association, Consumer Brands Association, and the American Beverage Association, you know, trying to undermine these progressive policies and these policies that would benefit, quite frankly, millions of American families. Mm-hmm.
And so the trade associations, they come with many different names, do they not? Often names that are, as you said earlier, are meant to sort of lull the consumer into a sense that they're really talking to them and addressing their concerns. But in fact, they're funneling information directly from their dark overlord, as it were. I mean, is that right? I mean, I'm trying to think of like a couple of names of, I mean, like the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I know, you know, I follow the meat industry a lot. Now, they're a trade organization funded by the USDA through beef checkoff dollars. And they are constantly promoting, you know, eat beef message, which is supposed to be great for all cattle ranchers. So, you know, I'm not going to go into the various problems in the meat industry. But I feel like that's a good example of a trade association that pretends to be on the side of ranchers, but in fact it's really a shill for Tyson, Cargill, you know, JBS, et cetera. Is that the kind of organization that we're talking about, or the Pork Producers Council? I mean, those are sort of more direct, but there are other ones that are better concealed. Can you name some of those?
Yes. Well, I think the Consumer Brands Association is an interesting one because they just went through a rebrand. They changed their name.
Yeah, they were Grocers Manufacturers Association, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And in fact, when we released this report and they were asked for a statement, they said, you know, this report, you know, is about an organization that no longer exists, the Grocery Manufacturers of America. you know, we're a different organization
Fantastic.
Now. Meanwhile, their members are still the same. Yeah. They've got the same executive team, the same set of lobbyists. And so not much has changed. It's just sort of they gave themselves a makeover, you know, with this name change. And it's interesting because, you know, the word consumer is very front and center, that this is a pro-consumer group that is, you know, interested in fighting for ensuring that the consumer has, you know, choice and information, when in reality it's just a group doing the bidding of some of the most powerful food companies in the world.
Right. So Frito-Lay is really the big snack food brands are calling the shots, meanwhile masquerading as, oh yes, we're on your side, you poor fat diabetic high blood pressured slob. It's just unbelievable. Let's talk a little bit about the dark money. So the trade associations, the, you know, these lobbyists are kind of, okay, it's out there. But how, first of all, who is paying the dark money and how did you find it? How were you able to identify those sources, or were you?
Well, no, that's the thing about dark money, right? It's not easy to find. So dark money is essentially money pooled through opaque channels, such as political organizations, shell corporations, super PACs. And what's interesting about dark money is it's purposely designed to shield the identity of the donors from public view, right? There's no IRS required reporting on this. There's no disclosures. Trade associations contribute to this murky dark money picture because they are often conduits for dark money from their member corporations. So trade associations right now can hide the sources of their contributions. Some of these groups don't even have member lists. Wow. Made public. We don't know who are, you know, technically the corporate members of these groups. And that's one of the ways they obscure, you know, where the money is coming from and also what activities they're spending the money on. You know, the it's interesting because the exemption around that created this dark money is actually a relic of the civil rights era. It was used at the time to protect NAACP donors from persecution. And to hide their identities. Yeah. But this exemption now has really created this problem of all of these dark money organizations that use tax-exempt status to try to influence political debate, electoral outcomes, government policies, and there's a complete lack of transparency and accountability. So there's legislation being proposed in Congress to try to require greater visibility, sunlight into these dark money groups and disclose donors.
Mm. Well, we won't hold our breath for that, but let's hope. You had another really interesting quote, I fear I might be a little bit redundant here, but I just want to get this out. You explain how the food industry works the pay to play system. And what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, these trade associations are spending millions of dollars in trying to influence elections. And they influence elections not because they care about which, you know, representative is going to Congress from the, you know, 110th district, but rather because those representatives sit on key committees, usually the House, you know, Agriculture Committee and the equivalent in the Senate. And they can have access, right? As campaign donors, they have access to these politicians and they go in and they lobby and they present their case. And you know, it's a quid pro quo. I mean, it's so interesting that we tolerate this, as a country, that this is just sort of, you know, a feature and not a bug of our democratic system.
Right.
And I think really what has opened the floodgates is, of course, you know, rulings like Citizens United, right, that enabled all this, you know, corporate and special interest money to flood the system to the point where we have a system almost of legalized corruption.
Mm-hmm.
That this kind of corruption where it is pay to play, where, you know, you give money to a candidate, they end up in Congress, they end up sitting on a key committee, and then you go in and, you know, you have this member of Congress, you'd lobbied and then they write in into the legislation things that are favorable for your industry, for your company. You know, that's corruption, but it's allowed.
Yeah.
You know, in under the law and under the rules of this country. And so I think you know, if we care about the food that we eat, if we care about how it's grown, what the impact is on workers, on the environment, We need to also start paying attention to how our democracy is set up and, quite frankly, being manipulated by all of this corporate money.
Yeah, I think we really can bring this right back to Citizens United. I mean, there's always been, you know, corruption in the sense of politicians being bought and paid for and so forth, but never to the extent that we are seeing in this era, to my knowledge. I mean, I'm a baby boomer, so I'm in my mid-60s. And certainly we all talked about corruption, you know, when Reagan was president. But it is beggaring the imagination at this point. And reading a report like yours really was extraordinarily eye-popping to see just how big the sums of money are and also the number of organizations that are involved in doing this very same work. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Lucy Martinez Sullivan talking about the new Feed the Truth report, Draining the Big Food Swamp. Please stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along, a three-day hosted virtual garden festival connecting you with the influencers, tastemakers, and cutting-edge content of today's gardening world. The Great Grow Along will feature 40-plus sessions on topics ranging from houseplants to DIY landscaping. New plant parents and first-time gardeners will gain practical advice and creative inspiration from celebrated garden experts and industry leaders. Costing $29.95, tickets allow attendees to mix and match a wide range of sessions, or choose to follow one of the conference's six tracks, which include edible gardening, urban gardening, pollinators and plants, DIY landscaping, houseplants, and dig deeper. The Great Grow Along will take place March 19th through 21st, 2021. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
So, we were talking about lobbying. And one of the points that you made that I thought was really interesting was that lobbying during the time frame surrounding the negotiations around a new farm bill every 5 years peaks. Talk a little bit about how that plays out and how much money these people are spending to influence legislation or you know, allocations within the farm bill.
Yeah, so the Farm Bill is this massive piece of legislation, I think as many of your listeners know,
absolutely.
that directs, you know, more than $425 billion in federal spending over a five-year period. And so there's a lot of interests that care about the Farm Bill, that that jockey for position within the Farm Bill, that so lobbying goes up. And the trade associations that we profiled collectively spent almost $40 million in 2009 around the Farm Bill. And that's a really, you know, significant sum of money. You know, just again, just these top 20 trade associations,
okay,
right? That doesn't even include the member organizations like the, you know, the Pepsis or the Cargills or the Tysons that also do separate lobbying. And I think it really speaks to, you know, just the intense focus that these companies have on this piece of legislation that, you know, sets the rules of you know, everything from our federal nutrition program SNAP to you know, to how money for agriculture is allocated. So I think it's one of those great phenomenons in DC. Where we see this massive spike around the farm.
Yeah, it's easy to see, for example, like why an Archer Daniel Midland or a Cargill would have a very vested interest in manipulating crop subsidies, for example, or how crop insurance is laid out, things like that you can really see. But then also, it would also be, you know, a place where these lobbyists, say, in the American Beverage Association would put a lot of muscle behind changing rules around school food, because school food, of course, is paid for by the Farm Bill, right? So, or SNAP benefits, of course, very much are you know, are a big part of the Farm Bill every year. So it's not hard to see why they would go after that. And, you know, as you say, $40 million doesn't even take into account the sort of individual corporate contributions made to individual people on the agricultural committee. And one thing I want to say before we go any further is when I was looking at your charts about individual giving, you included, you know, sort of which members of Congress, which senators got how much money from which organization. And it wasn't just Republicans. It was predominantly Republicans. I'm not going to lie. But there were quite a few Democrats on that corporate tit as well. And I wondered if you wanted to comment a little bit about that. Like Colin Peterson, for example, was a Democrat who was the chair of the House Agricultural Committee. You know, he was taking in a tidy sum every year. And his actions were not super friendly towards, say, you know, revised regional farm, you know, farming plans or food hubs or anything like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. The spending is bipartisan. It does tilt more on the Republican side, and that might be, you know, a product of the fact that Republicans tend to be more big business friendly, but also that they've been, you know, controlling the House and Senate for a while now. But yeah, Democrats reap the benefits of all of this campaign spending, and you know the food swamp pre-existed Donald Trump,
sure.
and is still here as Biden, you know, assumes the presidency. And I think it's going to take a tremendous amount of political courage and political will to actually do something about it, right? And so we can't assume that just because we have a Democratic administration and the House is controlled by Democrats and the Senate is sort of, you know, it kind of split, but, you know, a bit more tilting, slightly more Democratic. We can't assume that the Democrats are going to really focus on rooting out these big corporate and special interests. It's going to take serious commitment on the part of the Biden administration to tighten ethics rules, as well as Congress to pass legislation like the historic H.R. 1 for the People Act, which, among many, many other things, includes measures to promote greater transparency around lobbying, greater disclosure, and really try to minimize the impact of big money on politics. Mm.
Yeah, that is going to be a challenge. It's also worth saying that the big agricultural states who benefit the most from something like the Farm Bill also tend to have very conservative voters. Farmers in general tend to be conservative, even if they're registered Democrats. I think that they support, you know, a lot of the sort of Republican agenda in the sense of like, get out of my business. I don't want the government telling me how to manage the water on my farm or my ranch, you know, that stuff, because stuff like that. It's definitely a truism that frequently you will find some of these groups voting against their own best interests. especially when it comes to things like the Farm Bill. I mean, I can see, you know, it's not hard to see why even a Democrat would accept lobbying money or campaign money from say an Archer Daniel Midland type organization, just because their farmers might very well tend to want to support whatever it is that those companies are asking for in their quid pro quo. But let's move on a little bit. So you had some interesting examples of from how the Consumer Brands Association, formerly known as the Grocery Manufacturers Association, has skewed legislation or regulations in their favor. And I wanted you to give, like, I know you mentioned this at the top of the show, but let's just go through these three organizations and talk about some of the major impacts that they were able to skew in their favor. For example, how many hours a truck driver was allowed to drive, or GMO labeling, or front of the package nutrition. You alluded to those, but are there other ones that the Consumer Brands Association could be identified as having had an impact on?
I think in terms of the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015, they threw their support behind that. And that was really about creating this voluntary labeling program. But to disclose, you know, what's in food. But really, it was actually an effort to prohibit state efforts to enact their own labeling requirements. Uh-huh. The bill was nicknamed sort of the Dark Act, which was Deny Americans the Right to Know Act.
Right.
Because they argued that, you know, making participation in this labeling program voluntary would limit compliance. And so, they put their muscle behind it. You know, and it never ended up going anywhere, but it's one example. Of course, you know, GMO labeling, they were very, right, you know, active in that terrain. On the truck driver hours, I mean, you mentioned that, and this actually came about, as a result of the pandemic. The U.S. transportation, you know, were allowing truck drivers to log extra hours, because they were hauling essential goods, i.e. food. And the Consumer Brands Association lobbied to make those rules permanent in May of last year, despite the fact that there's well-documented safety risks to drivers, you know, on these long-haul routes. And so that's, you know, one example of how, you know, they took advantage of COVID, quite frankly, yeah, to make something that was supposed to be a temporary solve for the, you know, out of stocks and shortages we were all seeing at the grocery store, and really make that permanent in order to benefit their member corporations' bottom lines.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And then the American Beverage Association, of course, I always think, you know, they basically crushed the sugar tax, you know, sugar sweetened beverage tax, everywhere except for Berkeley and Philadelphia, I think. But what other measures have they sought to either suppress or express?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things. First of all these trade associations like to sponsor research. So they, you know, they pay for research that, you know, serves as the evidence base for their policy agendas. So the American Beverage Association funded about 26 studies that tried to really dispute the link between sugary drinks and obesity and diabetes, which of course contradicts the overwhelming body of, right, of scientific evidence that states to, you know, to the contrary. You know, they're trying to obfuscate the fact that added sugars do have there is a correlation between added sugars and the increasing prevalence of obesity. And so really trying to, you know, muddy the waters on the scientific front. On the regulatory side of things, you mentioned the, you know, their efforts at the state and local level, but there's a reason we don't even have a conversation about a national soda tax, right? I mean, this organization is, as you said, they fund Democrats, they fund Republicans. There's been no serious effort that's made it out of committee in Washington, D.C. to advance any kind of measure on a tax on sugar-sweetened beverage, despite the evidence showing that it decreases consumption of sugary beverages, which, you know, contribute to a whole host of health problems, particularly around, you know, among Black and Latino populations. And by the way, this tax would be a huge source of revenue that can go fund things like the CDC and other public health measures. Mm-hmm. So they are so active, of course, at the state level and doing preemption legislation. Mm-hmm. So they want to block efforts at the local level by going to the state capitals, and they, you know, they work with the Koch brothers, the organization they fund, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, right, to prevent you know, cities from passing taxes on soda. So the American Beverage Association is pretty they realize that soda taxes are an existential threat, and so they are there to be the heavy on that issue in particular.
I mean, it's interesting that they think of it as an existential threat. People who want to drink soda are going to drink it, and if they pay an extra 3 cents a bottle, it's not going to break the, but it would fund healthcare. You know what I mean? It's like, it's, I mean, to me, it's incredibly short-sighted, because basically you're saying that people are, you know, you don't want to pay the extra, you don't want to, you know, have that extra 3 cents a bottle, but you don't mind if your consumers perish, if they die an early death because of, right, uncontrolled health issues derived from, that's drinking, right, sugary beverages. I mean, it's incredibly short-sighted to me. It's like, you know, crazy. And then go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say the companies, they privatize the profits, but then the costs are really passed on to us, the taxpayers, who have to pay, you know, for you know, for healthcare costs for a population that's increasingly you know, saddled with diet related diseases like obesity and diabetes.
Right. And then, of course, you know, just to round this out, and then we must move on to solutions because we're running out of time here.
Yes.
And we have to get to that. But maybe I'll just say this: at the National Restaurant Association, you guys highlight the point that they have been very busy squelching the minimum wage, and especially squelching the raising of the tipped wage worker compensation, which I think is at $2.77 an hour, and then you're supposed to make up your, you know, the extra, essentially up to $15 an hour is what, you know, that's considered the what you're supposed to get out of your tips. And of course, as we all know, when you waitress at Applebee's or McDonald's, or not McDonald's, but at Applebee's or any of the other quick service restaurants where you're sitting down, that ain't happening. You're not making that money. So let's talk about the solutions, because you guys had some good ideas there. So I'll let you just take the floor and I'll shut up for now.
No, I mean, these are all such great questions, Katie. I think, you know, number one, we have to understand that this is the power that these food corporations and their trade groups wield, you know, impacts everything having to do with food. Mm-hmm. So we propose five solutions. Number one, and the revolving door between government and industry, because we talked about how revolving between government and industry allows these corporate interests to become entrenched in our policymaking, entrenched in the decision making, and it's to the detriment of our health and quite frankly to our economy.
Yeah.
Number two, Congress should pass the For the People Act, right? So this is a piece of legislation that would curb the toxic influence of corporate money in politics, Tighten ethics rules, and increase transparency. So this is broader, of course, than just the food industry, but would have a big impact on how our food policy is determined, by whom, and for what purpose. Mm-hmm. Number three, trade associations and other vehicles for dark money should no longer be allowed to hide the sources of their contributions and expenditures. This is a huge problem. We don't know who's behind all of this lobbying, all of this campaign spending. And it really is adding, fueling the corruption that we see in our democracy. So that's a critical act or a critical effort that Congress needs to take seriously. Number four, we're calling on food corporations and trade groups to immediately open their books. So feed the truth. We want to see these groups disclose the totality of their political giving,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
And so they talk a good game. These corporations talk a good game about transparency and how important it is for, you know, consumers to know what they're buying and what's in their food and all that. Well, transparency should also extend to the political activities of these companies. And no longer should we tolerate a company like, you know, Coke or Pepsi or Nestle talking about the good that they do in our communities and the philanthropy and the money that they give, without, you know, then equally talking about what they're spending on influencing our elections, on lobbying to get their way.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, hey, listen, an idea whose time has come. Put a stop to the political donations and put a stop to lobbying. Corporations should close their PACs, their, you know, political action committees. And I tell you, there is momentum on this front.
Really?
Investors in these publicly traded corporations are starting to see that corporations' political giving is a liability. It's a liability for companies, and it's something that that the investment community, particularly socially responsible investors, are asking, hey, is it worth the risk that these corporations, which are supposed to, you know, maximize shareholder value, is it worth the risk to our democratic institutions? And, you know, is it worth the liability from a reputation standpoint for these companies to continue to be in the business of donating cash, you know, to elect certain members of Congress or lobbying? So I think, you know, it might seem like a radical idea, but that's certainly something that Feed the Truth is going to push for.
Yeah, that is easily the most radical idea you have mentioned. And it's also the one that makes my eyebrows go up the highest. largely because I feel like, you know, shareholders are, most shareholders in a company are pretty unaware of what their company is doing. They're not really reading those annual reports. And to my, you know, in my experience, my granted very little experience, my experience in sort of examining the way, first of all, what annual reports look like, but also how much disclosure goes into those annual reports in terms of what shareholders know that their company's lobbying or that their, you know, that the corporation's lobbying interests are supporting. I don't think that that's necessarily particularly transparent to people who do own shares in a corporation like ADM or Pepsi Cola or something like that. I think there are companies out there like As You Sow or Ceres that are trying to get shareholders more aware of what's going on and to put pressure on the board members of a corporation to somehow do better. You know, I don't know if it means stop doing it altogether, but do better or support better candidacies. But I just feel like there's an enormous, not only inertia to overcome, but also a huge level of fundamental ignorance about it. I mean, I at the risk of going on and on too long here, I just want to say, like, to go back to the revolving door issue, I'll never forget a conversation I had with Thomas Massey, who's a congressman from Kentucky, I think. And I said, well, I asked him a couple questions about, you know, sort of regulating the food industry in some way or something like that. He says, well, we just let the food industry take care of its own concerns. They're doing a great job of feeding everyone. And I mean, he was genuinely ignorant. I said, but, you know, Congressman, are you aware that there are over 40 million food insecure households in the United States? At which point he terminated the conversation and walked away from me. Like, he just didn't want to know that, or if he knew it, he didn't want to acknowledge it. But the main point was, is that he didn't care whether or not, you know, he didn't want to be bothered with thinking about, you know, with the hard thinking that is required to sort of unravel the harms that these food corporations are doing from the good things that they're doing. I mean, you know, we all say the food system is broken. It's not broken. It works incredibly well. It just doesn't work well for people. It works really well for corporations. So, you know, you've got a massive education effort on your hands, not only with, you know, the corporations themselves, with the legislators who are in bed with them through these revolving doors, but then also consumers. Nobody thinks of looks at a package of Doritos and thinks, well, there's the Antichrist. But, you know, in a way, that's what you're looking at. You know, it's like really cheap calories. They're really destructive. It's terrible for the environment. You know, they really should cease to exist, except, of course, we all love them. So, it's a very difficult set of problems compounded by the consolidation within the food industry categories. So, you know, my hat's off to you, Lucy Sullivan. And I really look forward to hearing more from you and from Feed the Truth. I mean, you got to come back and tell me, you know, all of the rest of the stuff that you discover. I think we should have like a regular call scheduled.
Let's do it, Katie. I'm all in.
I mean, really, I mean, I love having recurring guests. And it's easier for me, but also it continues the thread for my listeners because then they can catch up on an issue. Like if they liked this program, they can say, oh, I want to hear part two and then go to that, you know, podcast list and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to pick up on this again, see what's happening. So we will do that. So in the meantime, we have now gone slightly over time. Not that there's really any time frame, but people tune out after about 35 minutes. So I like to keep it kind of short, but thank you so very much. I wish you all the best with this organization and great job on that report. I'm not kidding. I sent it to at least a half a dozen of my friends.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. And you had a great, we should also mention that you had a piece in Civil Eats in today's issue of Civil Eats. So if you don't know how to access, we haven't given you a chance to tell people where to access the report or learn more about the Feed the Truth. Promote yourself shamelessly, woman.
Yes, feedthetruth.org. You can find the report on the website. There's also links to petitions that you can sign to get these companies to open their kimonos, so to speak, open their books, be be a lot more transparent about what they're doing. And join us. This is just the tip of the iceberg. This whole issue, it's a massive iceberg underneath the water, and we're just getting started. So thank you, Katie, so much for having me. And again, feedthetruth.org. We look forward to continuing the conversation.
Absolutely.
With you and your listeners.
It's a date. Talk to you soon, Lucy. Thank you so much. And thanks to my sponsor. Really appreciate it, as always. See you next week, folks. I appreciate you tuning in, and have a great week in the meantime. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio. Thanks.